You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the Community Oncology Connection SmartCast, micro-learning podcast series hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Sylvia Hanna, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast, which is the first in a series of three podcasts. In this series, we will be covering the management of different types of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. At times, there can be the incorrect belief that these patient populations are ineligible for certain treatment options due to limited research and exclusion from clinical trials that were used to obtain FDA approval. In this series, we will discuss the geriatric population and immunocompromised patients, including those with autoimmune disease and HIV. In the first episode, we will review a case of a geriatric patient with stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung. This podcast will include discussion of the treatment management strategies and applicable clinical trial data. Joining me today is Dr. Jared Weiss, Professor of Medicine and Section Chief of Thoracic and Head and Neck Oncology at University of North Carolina, Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome, Dr. Weiss. It is so good to have you with us today.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Weiss, let's begin with a case of a geriatric patient with stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung. Can you tell us about this patient?
Sure. So this is a 75-year-old man with mild COPD and hypertension who presents with stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung. At the time of diagnosis, he is mildly symptomatic with cough, and he was referred to hospice because of his age and seeks a second opinion because he's interested in life-prolonging therapy.
Dr. Weiss, in this setting, are there treatment options available to a patient like this outside of hospice?
Absolutely. There's a long history of therapeutic nihilism when it comes to the older patient, even the fit older patient with lung cancer, but there's a large base of data to argue against that nihilism. We know that these days we're in a modern era with wonderful targeted therapies and immunotherapies, but if we go back even earlier, go back decades to the time when we only had cytotoxic chemotherapy, which we know is less effective than many modern therapeutics and more toxic. Even in that era, we have data to suggest that we should treat the fit older patient. Study with a very cool name, ELVIS, started us off. What ELVIS did was it randomized fit older patients to single agent chemotherapy with vinorelbine or to best supportive care alone. The first finding, the more obvious one, is that survival was better with treatment than not. But the more surprising finding was that quality of life was also better with treatment than not. Now, here we have to consider that in terms of physical quality of life, there are two major things that hurt our patients. Their treatment, meaning the suffering induced by side effects of treatment, but also the cancer, the suffering induced by the cancer. And so in ELVIS, the suffering from the reduction in suffering from the cancer outweighed the suffering created by side effects. Now, at that time, we already knew that younger patients should be treated not with one drug, but with two, with a platinum doublet. And we had subgroup analyses on the trial showing that, showing similar findings in the older patient. Nonetheless, controversy ensued until the French intervened with the IFCT-0501 trial. Maybe the French need catchier names for their trials. But more importantly, this trial randomized fit older patients to doublet chemotherapy or single agent. Survival was better with the doublet, and quality of life came even. An interesting element of that trial was that a third of the patients had PS2. And so in that population, the finding was the same as in patients with performance status 0 and 1 with the overall population. So even the less fit elderly patient benefited from doublet. And interestingly, roughly contemporaneously, we had a Brazilian trial in PS2 patients, one third of whom were elderly. And in that subgroup of PS2 elderly patient, the same finding held. And so even in the chemotherapy era, we had firmly established that we should treat the fit older patient just like younger patients.
Dr. Weiss, with the advancements in therapeutic options and the availability of targeted therapy and immunotherapy, does this change the current management approach in the elderly patient with NSCLC?
Absolutely. In summary, the changes are the same as for younger patients, but with exclamation points. What I mean by that is that when we match target with targeted therapy of a patient, say with EGFR mutation who gets an EGFR inhibitor, we get certain themes. These themes are much less toxic therapy, much more effective therapy, and it demedicalizes the life of the patient because they're pills instead of IV. These are wonderful advances, and it's even more so true for the elderly, right? With a less toxic, more effective therapy, your quality of life and survival advantage are even more pronounced. And a similar theme comes with immunotherapy. For properly selected patients, immunotherapy can offer less toxicity with greater efficacy and help overcome that therapeutic nihilism. So if we know that our fit older patient can receive the same chemotherapeutic options as a younger patient, then the question becomes, is there yet something better that might make more patients treatment eligible or offer less toxic, more effective treatments for even the most fit older patients? And this is where targeted therapy and immunotherapy come in. When you match target with targeted therapy, as a theme, you get treatments that are less toxic and more effective than chemotherapy. And with PD-L1 testing for immunotherapy, we can identify some patients with a high probability of response to mono immunotherapy, meaning that with a non-chemo treatment option, with just immunotherapy, that they might have a high chance of response with less toxicity. Of course, it's critical to get this testing because if we don't test for a molecular option, if we don't do molecular testing, there's no chance of finding the molecular target that we can action. And similarly, if we don't do PD-L1 immunotherapy testing, then we won't know to find those PD-L1 high patients who might be offered mono immunotherapy.
What exactly are you testing for with the molecular testing? What did molecular testing reveal in this patient, for example?
That's a very important question. In the modern era, in wealthy nations, the testing should be both comprehensive and sensitive. It is a mistake to get a la carte testing for just EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, for example, as is commonly done. The good testing is DNA and RNA next generation sequencing with RNA fusion. And there are multiple commercial vendors that offer this, making it available all across the country. In addition, we should be testing for PD-L1 in all patients. And in this process, you get everything. This molecular testing is very important because it identifies patients who might be a candidate for targeted therapy. You can't give an EGFR inhibitor unless you know, for example, that the patient has EGFR mutation. For patients of any age, this targeted therapy is less toxic and more effective than chemotherapy. Similarly, you can only find your PD-L1 highs if you test for PD-L1. And so in this patient, what was done was a DNA and RNA next generation sequencing panel. It happened to be Tempus, and a PD-L1 test was performed. In addition, this patient had a comprehensive geriatric assessment. The latter is not so much to decide whether the patient is fit for treatment, but to identify individual strengths and frailties that can guide supportive services and interventions that can both maximize ability to tolerate therapy as well as to improve quality of life directly. In this individual patient, the molecular testing returned without an actionable driver mutation, and the PD-L1 was 1%. So it was positive, but low. The patient himself had done extensive research online about treatment options for non-small cell lung cancer, and his values were oriented strongly towards life-extending therapy. He wanted the most aggressive therapy available, and he therefore inquired about treatment with nivolumab, ipilimumab, and cytotoxic doublet.
And based on the patient's wishes and the findings, what was the treatment plan that the interdisciplinary care team and the patient decided on?
The regimen that he came inquiring about is called the 9LA data. And interesting, in the CheckMate 9LA study, there was benefit both in PD-L1 positive and PD-L1 negative patients. And they were pretty similar. In the PD-L1 positive population, which is our patient, survival was significantly longer in the experimental than in the control group, at a median of 5.8 months compared to 10.9 months, or for those who prefer hazard ratios, 0.64. In the PD-L1 negative population, overall survival was 16.8 versus 9.8 months, or hazard ratio of 0.62. When we look at the presentation of elderly subgroup analyses in immunotherapy trials, they are quite heterogeneous in terms of the age cutoffs and the extent to which the analyses are powered, very much limiting the ability of effective cross-trial comparison. However, in considering this patient, we must note that the very small, only 28-patient subgroup analysis of patients aged at least 75 years in that study trended towards favoring chemotherapy alone in that trial. Whereas in contrast, the less than 65 and 65 to 75 year subgroups favored the quadruplet. There was a similar trial of dual immunotherapy without chemo, the 227 trial, which looked at ipilimumab and nivolumab. And in that trial, in both the 65 and to 75 group and the 75 plus group, the trends in these older subgroups was in the right direction, but less so for younger patients. And so for this patient, we talked about the triplet regimen of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab.
Very interesting. How would the management of this patient differ if he had active EGFR mutation and PD-L1 of 100?
You ask a very important question because it's one of the most common mistakes that I see made in my consultative practice. There's a simple answer here that once you know that the patient has EGFR mutation, and I would argue probably also ALK or RET, it doesn't matter what the PD-L1 is anymore. Those molecular markers are such strong negative predictors for immunotherapy efficacy that the right thing to do is to give them targeted therapy. You do it, number one, because the targeted therapy is going to be effective. Number two, because the immunotherapy is unlikely to be effective. And number three, the subtlest but very important of these points, is that when you finally do the right thing, which is to give the targeted therapy, it has a higher risk of side effects if given immediately after immunotherapy.
How would the management of this patient differ if no actionable mutation was found?
Here, we need to be clear on what no actionable mutation found means. There are two kinds of negative reports. In the first kind, no driver is found at all. In that case, you need to push further to find the driver. You need to make sure that you have a good specimen and that you've done it with a sensitive method. The other kind is you've found the driver, but it makes you sad. It's a driver that you can't do anything about. And that's the case of what I really mean when I say no actionable mutation or driver negative. And so let's say this patient had one of those, like say KRAS G12V. I think that actually was the one in the real case. And with a PD-L1 of 1%, so low but positive, there are multiple reasonable regimens. In the real case, I recommended and the patient accepted carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab based on the KEYNOTE-189 data. But I do want to mention briefly that there are other approved and reasonable options. For example, carboplatin, nab-paclitaxel, and atezolizumab based on EMPOWER-130, or chemotherapy plus cemiplimab based on EMPOWER-Lung3.
And since we're discussing the elderly population, how effective is immunotherapy in this population? Is there data available?
There's absolutely data available and even review articles summarizing it. The quick answer is that most of the subgroup analyses on older patients showed the same answer as far as what you should do as younger patients. So that where younger patients benefited from immunotherapy in most of these subgroup analyses, so did older patients. We have already discussed possible exceptions that with dual immunotherapy, particularly in the 75 plus population, that is less certain.
Very informative. Now, returning to the patient case, how did he do on treatment?
So as mentioned, he received carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab. His side effect profile was quite mild. He had fatigue. He had some myelosuppression. He had a little bit of a rash. But nothing more than grade one, nothing that really hurt quality of life. He had imaging after two cycles that showed a very nice response that deepened a little bit after four. At that point, he went on to maintenance therapy with pemetrexed and pembrolizumab. After another, I forget, four or five cycles of that, his creatinine started to creep up a little bit. He got a bit more tired. His counts were getting a bit more suppressed. So the pemetrexed was dropped. And he was maintained on pembrolizumab maintenance therapy alone. And we're now going on about a year since the initiation of his therapy, and he's still thriving.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Weiss. That was very informative, particularly in the elderly patient population, where some may believe that treatment options are unavailable or limited. We learned a lot today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please join us in the other two podcasts where we discuss immunocompromised patients, including those with autoimmune disorders and HIV. And Dr. Weiss is going to come back to discuss those with us. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing education, medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity.